Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello one and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddow, and wherever you are in the world, it's great to have you with us. And today, as ever, I'm joined by two brilliant writers who'll be going head-to-head in a war of the words a little later on in the Book Off, where each of them will tell us about a book they love and think that we should all read. So let's meet them. My first guest is the author of over 30 books and is a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He has received the Hurst and Wright Legacy Award and the Penn Center USA Award for Fiction, and his work has been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. He is Distinguished Professor of English at the University of Southern California, and recently, in 2000, his 2001 novel, Erasure, was adapted into the award-winning film American Fiction. Here to tell us about his latest novel, James, it's Percival Everett. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's so good to see you. Thank you for coming. And my second guest has also been nominated for the Booker Prize, as well as being voted one of Granter's best of young British novelists in 2003. We won't dwell on the date. And won the E.M. Forster Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He is editor-at-large of the London Review of Books and a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. And joining us from Scotland to tell us about his new novel, Caledonian Road, it's Andrew O'Hagan. Hello to you.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very well. All the better for seeing you. I'm glad we could connect the wires from Edinburgh down here to London. And the introductions, even though you've already sort of said hello off mic, Andrew Percival. Percival, Andrew.
Hey, Percival.
I'm pleased to meet you, Andrew.
And it's fabulous to have you both here. And over the next 30 minutes, we're going to talk about your wonderful new novels. We'll find out what you've been reading, what you've been enjoying reading recently. And of course, we'll do the Book Off. But first, Percival, if I may, come to you and talk about James, because that is why you're here in the UK, and you've been talking about James a lot, I think, over the last few days. This is not a retelling. Would you say it's a reimagining? Is that a more accurate description of Huckleberry Finn?
No.
Okay.
I'm not sure what it is. I'm revisiting, perhaps, the world of Huckleberry Finn. Not so much the text, but that world.
Hmm. And could you set up this story for us, which some people may think they know?
Well, Twain's novel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, is about a... It's told by a young boy, an adolescent, a white boy, who is running away from home, running away from his abusive father. He's faked his own murder. And it's an adventure story, a picaresque, a coming-of-age story. And as he moves through the landscape of the American South, he's accompanied by a slave named Jim. Jim is depicted as rather simple, not articulate at all, and they have a relationship. In fact, Jim is the only positive male role model that this child has. In the novel, it's quite clear that Huckleberry Finn represents an adolescent America moving through its own landscape. And as such, he's dealing with the thorny issue and the persistent issue that was, is at the time of the novel and continues to be the most defining feature of the American experience, which is race. He's trying to reconcile the fact that his friend Jim is property and also a human being. Mm. And that's a pretty remarkable thing for a novel. At that time, no one had really addressed it. Mm.
And so tell us about what you've done.
Oh, in my version, it's narrated by not a child, but by a grown man, a man who has a child, who has a wife. He's a family man. Yeah. He's become literate secretly in the library of one of the figures in Huck's life, Judge Thatcher. His literacy is important because it's a source of danger for him. If white people know that he can read, then he becomes a danger to them, and so his life is threatened. And he runs away because he learns he's going to be sold away from his family. He runs away so that he might be able to raise money to buy his family or come back and steal them, but he is not going to be sold down the river, as the saying goes. Mm. At the same time, Huck fakes his own murder, runs away, and complicates Jim's life in that he's run away at the time that they believe a boy has been murdered. And so he is, therefore, in his mind, the only suspect. And so that creates the tension and the impetus of their continued running.
And it's a fabulous novel. I really enjoyed it and want to talk a little bit more about it shortly. Andrew, if I could come to you and talk about Caledonian Road, though. I wondered, when did you first recognise, if there was indeed a moment, that Caledonian Road could be and indeed should be the setting of one of your books?
You know, I lived in Caledonian Road in the early 90s, arrived there, like many Scots, off the train at King's Cross. I was one of those Scots who actually made it out of the station. In those days, many of my countrymen would just sit down on the concourse with a can of special brew and never leave. But I actually went outside the station into the adjacent street and got to know Caledonian Road very well. It was always one of those streets in London that had this almost incredible mix of human types, people from all walks of life. On the one side of the street, you had people living in those elegant Georgian squares where the house prices, we watched them go from already expensive to colossally multi-million pound expensive. Whilst on the other side of the road, not 300 yards away, people were living in social housing. Migrants into the city were taking up residence in those houses there. And I noticed something when I began to sort of peel back the research, which was that the famous Charles Booth poverty maps of London of 1890 gave a colour coding to those streets. Red and pink for very well off, blue and black for criminal classes, as they called them then in the Victorian era, rather judgmentally. And various shades in between. And when you lay that colour map of the economic condition of Caledonian Road and London from the Victorian period over present-day London, here's the news. It's exactly the same.
Wow. You know,
that's after 120 years, 130 years of a welfare state, the NHS, ideological growths and changes and steps back, feminism, humanitarian ventures of one sort and another. We are in exactly the same position when it comes to inequality in big cities. And that would be true, I venture, of New Orleans or Paris or Rome or Athens. You can take that however you will, but for a novelist, it's a provocation, you know, to write, if you like, into the difficulty of that truth. Many things have changed, but many things have remained the same.
Gosh, yeah, that's unbelievable about the Booth map and putting it over a current day one. I did not know that. This book's taken, you know, it's been a long time coming.
Yeah.
And we're all thrilled it's finally here. In fact, I mentioned just outside in our studio to one of our colleagues that I was about to speak to you, and she was beside herself about a new Andrew Hagen book. How does it feel to you? Because obviously you've lived with this and it's now out in the world. How do you feel?
Well, I'll tell you what is really nice and That's the best word for it. It's nice and it's surprising that, you know, here we are in 2024 where you can hardly move for people talking about the dumbing down of cultures and that nothing can be taken seriously anymore and everybody's on their computer and all the kids are addicted to TikTok and a literary novel has no chance of making its way through into the culture. Well, here's the news. Percival's book's doing the same thing. People do actually want to read what used to be called serious fiction. I remember I went to Provincetown years ago to talk to Norman Mailer for the Parish Review in their famous writer series. He was one of the few writers in the history of that interview series to be interviewed twice. And I was the second time. And I was talking to him about the publication of his first novel, The Naked and the Dead, published in the early 50s, very much a war novel. And it had been described to me by many people that I'd got to know in America who were old enough, the phenomenon of being in a trolley car, as they called it, in San Francisco or in a bus in New York or in the subway and looking up and noticing that almost everyone was reading the same novel. That is something we thought had gone out of literary culture. And maybe it has in that scale. But it's nice to know that, as we're finding with James Percival's book this week, everybody's talking about it. There's not one of us who will be able to hold our heads up if we haven't read it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a nice feeling, you know, that in the morass of culture and advertising and marketing that we live in now, with algorithms telling us daily who we are, minute by minute, who we are and what we like, that we can actually make a choice for ourselves. And we seem to be making the same one, and that's to take a piece of literary work seriously.
Yeah. And what I have found more recently with the introduction of Kindles and e-readers and people looking at their phones is you don't get that joy of looking down a carriage if you're on a train or on the metro, a tube train, to see what other people are reading, because you actually can't tell now unless they have a physical book. I often always do have a physical book, but it used to be that you could sort of get a snapshot of what everyone was reading. Do you remember that person?
I do quite well. And it would tell you if you wanted to talk to that person.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, or marry them.
Well, quite. Or if you're the author of it, go up and say, are you enjoying it?
No, I've always loved that story that's oft-told, I think, about Dickens's The Old Curiosity Shop. You know, people were reading it, of course, as they often were with Dickens and many of those Victorians. They were reading it in serial form, and they would wait at the harbour in New York for the latest bound serial to arrive, to know what had happened next. And apparently, they were all shouting from the dock to the ship, is little Nell still alive? When it got to that particular section of the book. Great. And that's a lovely notion of, what can we call it, communion between readers, that they all are having similar thoughts at the same time. In our period, that's quite hard to identify whether that's still happening. Maybe it is. I don't want to be depressing about it. Maybe the TikTokers, I've got a 20-year-old, he would probably tell me that they're communing in a perfectly healthy way. But I just love the idea of standing in the dock, shouting for the news about what's happening in a novel, you know?
Yeah, I love that image as well. Sort of the original box set, in some ways, the Dickens, isn't it? Well, we've spoken around it, Andrew, but perhaps you could just set up the story of this novel for us and introduce us to Campbell Flynn.
So Campbell Flynn, who's what Henry James used to call the centre of consciousness, he's the main man in this book, but there is 60 characters, and he's by no means the wisest, and indeed, this guy who we meet, who should be the guy who has everything, he's a successful art historian in his early 50s who lives in one of those big wedding cake style expensive houses in North London, just off the Caledonian Road, with a brilliant and beautiful psychotherapist for a wife and two high-achieving kids in their 20s. And he seems to be invited onto every single cultural program. He writes for The New Yorker. He's got a plump university job. And yet, as the reader discovers very quickly, something is off in this man's life. This reliable liberal intellectual, this guy who thought he was on the right side of history, who marched in all the right marches, wrote the right essays for The Atlantic, said the right things to The Guardian, suddenly he's got some young students, one in particular, Milo Mangasha, from Caledonian Road, who's asking him questions in a way that he's never been asked questions before. And so we're off to the races, I think, or at least I hope, and we have a bit of a drama going on here.
We are indeed off to the races. And we'll come back and talk about some of those 60 characters you mentioned in a minute, Andrew. Percival, I'm keen to know when you knew when you wanted to write this book and whether it's something that you've been thinking about for a long time or if it sort of just happened and then you wrote it.
Oh, it's so unromantic that you... I can't tell you that I was, for a long time, itching to write this novel. It started 3 years ago when I was... Now the story is that I was playing tennis and I'd hit a ball wildly out of the court. And as I watched the ball sail, I thought to myself, has anyone ever told this story from the perspective of Jim?
As that tennis ball was flying.
Yes, yeah. And which also explained to me why I hit the ball so poorly. And so I went home and started looking and no one had. And I wondered, why hasn't anyone done this? And I realized that my advanced age, I hadn't thought of it either, and so I decided to do it.
And when you do have that, so you have that sort of moment and think, why has it not been done? I'm going to be the one to do it then. What steps do you have to take, or did you take, in order to start tackling it? Did you just think, I'll reread the book, or I won't reread the book, and I'll just start from scratch? What did you do?
Well, being familiar with the text, I didn't want to revisit the text itself. Mm. I wanted to revisit the world that Twain has created or did create. And so what I did, my way, and I needed to own it.
Yeah.
So I read the novel 15 times row. I would end it and then just go back to the beginning.
Wow.
Until it was a blur, much in the way that when you repeat a word over and over again, it becomes nonsensical.
Yeah.
It became a blur. I hated the novel completely, but I knew, and so I put it down. And I still have never looked back at the novel. And then I started writing, and what's curious is I know that much of what's in it is in Huck Finn, but it's rendered quite differently, but the world is there, and that's what I needed. I even moved the world forward some 20 years.
Because you needed a civil war, right? So,
yeah, and it's much easier to move two people than the war.
Yes, yeah. That's right, yeah. But that experience of reading and rereading a text like that again and again straight after, that must have been...
We call it torture.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's because I can't imagine what that's like. But as you say, you get the world, and that's what's so important. And is it a place that you... knew well or at all, or did you have to sort of do extra research on top of that?
Well, I know the place. Mm-hmm. I did visit Hannibal, Missouri, which was completely without profit. I didn't need to go there at all, and I don't encourage anyone to do that. But it was really Twain's world that I needed to inhabit. It wasn't the physical world of the Mississippi.
Mm.
It did help that I'm a bit of an outdoorsman, so it did help that I understand rivers and I understand that river and I know the landscape.
And there's got to be something about, I know it's, we're talking about whenever you would have gone 2022, 2023, but like there's got to be a part of going to that place still that helps and maybe in some way subconsciously feeds into...
So I can see you're a romantic, and that's very nice. But
I definitely am, aren't I? Yeah. The way that... But no is the answer.
No, the answer is no.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I love that you, with each novel that you write, each book that you write, you want to learn. And you, I remember hearing you in an interview say that you sort of immerse yourself in the research and the academia around something. You learn it, and then it's gone.
Oh yeah, that's. You would think that I would know something about this world, but I don't. For my novel Watershed, I read 25 or 6 books on geomorphology and hydrology. I did 3 months of field work with a hydrologist. I don't know anything about hydrology.
That's amazing. Wow. So it works for the books, I suppose, whether it did, well, even if it stays or not.
I hope so. It did nothing for me, but I
What's the furthest you've gone in the name of research, Andrew?
I'm slightly too far into relationships with the minor royals in Britain. I think that would qualify as a too muchness. But too muchness seems to be my middle name at the moment. And too much time spent with gangs in South London, too much time spent with Russian oligarchs, as they spent too much money on too much wine. It was too much expensive. You know, the too muchness of my life has taken over at this point. And I'm looking for a life of quiet modesty in a cell, you know, an isolated life for me, I say, next time round. I know people keep saying a social novel, you know. The problem with social novels is you have to be sociable for a time, I find. And I'm very much against that. I'm almost politically against it. The idea of being too sociable from now on. I'll be having it tattooed in my rather wide forehead. Not available for chats, you know. Say nothing of
Do not disturb. On there.
Yes.
Well, you mentioned Milo already, Andrew. And you have such a great and varied cast of characters in this novel. Did you know when you started writing it that this story would bring in quite that many voices and viewpoints, or is it just evident as you started telling the story that that was going to happen?
I mean, it'd be interesting to hear what Percival thinks on this topic. For myself, I'm never sure that we ever know as much as people assume you know. I mean, not just in a lasting way about hydraulics, but even about our characters. We meet them for the first time at one point, as we do people in life. We meet them in our head, obviously, and we extract them from our head in a combination of that and perhaps having known something of them in the world too. But however they come temporarily. They come somewhat unknowably as well, and we make of them what we can. And but I have to say that for my sins, over 10 years ago, I was asked by the now world-famous Julian Assange to come and help him think about his memoir and help him write it. So I spent a lot of time under house arrest, not quite chained to Julian Assange, but certainly attached to him in the Ecuadorian embassy, and before that in an English country house. So I felt I was inside the world of what you might call ethical hacking, cryptocurrency, online politics became a kind of string on my bow for a while that I would thrum, sometimes dumbly, sometimes, you know, more expertly. But I'd come out of all that, and I found myself standing in the National Gallery in London one day trying to decompress from having spent too much time with hackers and their obsessions. And I was in the room where the Vermeers are, and there was a rather elegant art historian type wearing a rather beautiful tie talking to a young student. The student was really undermining everything that the art historian was saying in a rather brilliant way. It was impossible to to get away from it. I mean, I found it so compelling as a dramatic situation that this young guy who would really influence Milo Mangasha, he had a sort of cut glass intelligence and was just, he wouldn't allow this rather sort of, I could smell the guy, by the way, the art historian was wearing rather expensive cologne and it was traveling over the room just for me behind him. And a whole novel was starting to form in front of my eyes. That almost never happens. It's like a gift from the gods. Mm. And when he ever used the word civilization, this young guy would just lay into him. You know, the assumptions that this art historian were making were so brilliantly being deconstructed in front of my eyes. And I thought, Jesus Christ, I better get back to my study immediately. And 10 years later, we have something.
Wow, that's amazing. And not only those two, but as we've said, just a whole other cast of characters that bring the story to life as well. Would you agree with what Andrew's saying there, Percival, in terms of the characters sort of coming to you or how they come to you? Or is it different for you?
Well, it's different with different characters.
Mm.
Regardless of how they come, I have to make up their backgrounds and I have to make up stuff that's happened that can be referred to without referring to it. There can't be implication without something to imply. In order to have some nuance, there have to be prior conversations between characters that I have to imagine if they're going to exist, but they're not in the novels. Mm. But mainly it is, you're just making this stuff up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not really magic. Though it feels like it sometimes. You start with 400 or 500 pages of blank paper and all of a sudden it's filled with these marks and you wonder, what does this mean?
I did that.
Yeah. And I'm sorry.
Is it true that wherever you start writing a book is where you'll finish it?
Well, the last few books, if I start at the kitchen table, that's sort of where I end up. And I don't know if that's a function of COVID.
Maybe.
But the last few have been that way.
Yeah. Not a superstition or anything.
No, I don't shave my head when I'm done.
Before we find out what you've been reading and enjoying recently, both of you, can I just ask you very quickly, Percival, about American Fiction, which is obviously the Cord Jefferson film. It's based on your novel Erasure, as I mentioned earlier. And I absolutely loved it when I went to see it. And I just wondered, there's probably been a lot of talk about that to you, with you recently. Were you pleased with how it came out? Did you have any involvement in it, or has it just been a project that's happened and you can sort of see it as a consumer now?
No, I was given the credit executive producer in lieu of money. And, and so I really didn't have anything to do with the making of the film. I was involved with it because of the actor's strike.
Mm.
The actors weren't available to do interviews and press. So I filled that gap for a while. Right. And in spite of that, the movie did well. I enjoyed the film very much. I didn't expect to see my novel appear on screen. Mm. Cord Jefferson took my work, mined it, and made his film. He made a new work of art, and that's his job, and I like it very much.
Yeah, I thought it was really great, so I'm glad to hear that as well. So as I said, I always love to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently, whether it's a new book coming out or a new author to them. Andrew, I know you've probably been pretty busy with your own book, but have you found some time to read some other things? And is there anything you'd like to tell us about?
Well, you know, I caused my wife to turn to me on holiday recently. She demanded that I took 10 days holiday with her in Spain before setting off on what's going to be a 3-month book tour in various countries. So we went there and she said, I've been wondering when the moment would come when I'd have to tell you that you are fully mad, that the moment has arrived, because I see that you've brought us your reading material beside the pool, the collected diaries of Virginia Woolf, all 5 volumes. I said, what happened to detective novels? No, I just got to look at this. You know, I like nothing more than sitting beside a rather sort of ugly inflatable reading some of the most snobby sentences in the language, you know, morning and afternoon. So I have been reading the newly produced by Granta 5 volumes of Virginia Woolf's Diaries, and they are as snobbish as I remember them. They're as intolerant of people who aren't her as I remember. But I have to say, in these times when people maybe sometimes find it hard to find the humour in things they find politically unacceptable, that she is incredibly funny. Mm. Despite herself, or maybe because of herself, she is hilarious. There are some moments in this where I had to actually put the heavy books down. Just the specificity of her particular snobberies can make you laugh if you'll allow yourself that freedom. At the same time, I've been loving a book called Killing Thatcher by Rory Caro, a non-fiction book about the Brighton bombing in the 1980s, the well-known attempt by the IRA to blow up Margaret Thatcher. They failed to kill Thatcher, but they did cause death and injury in that that event. And I have to say, the detail of this bomb maker's life, this bomb planter's life, and the times that in which they did it is just kind of absorbing to an unbelievable degree. I really admired that book. It's a work of journalism, I suppose, but at a high level.
And that's called Killing Thatcher, you said?
Killing Thatcher, yes.
And to go back to your the Virginia Woolf Diaries as well, one point actually I did want to reference to both of you, but to you, Andrew, in terms of your novel, humour is obviously an important part of the way that you've written it, because there's a knowing there. And I think when I was reading it, there were some situations that I was in personally, sitting around the corner here, not that far from Caledonian Road, eating my Eggs Benedict or whatever, while I skimmed the pages of your book, thinking, okay, there's some subtle and humorous bits in this that come, through many scenes, but definitely through Campbell himself.
I've always believed in humour and comedies of manners as being very central to the novel in English. Mm. Not only the novel in English, I mean, the novel in Russian and the novel in Spanish, just as much, really. But to speak of the novel in English, it's always been so central. You know, it's there in Fielding, it's there in Dickens, it's there in Jane Austen, you know, it's there continually through our various traditions, I think. And I couldn't contemplate the sort of various manias that exist in our time. And we're all aware of them. We needn't list them. But whether it's for representation or for political purity of one kind and another, there is room to squeeze in some farce and some laughter into all of that, I think. And although we're always dealing with serious concerns, I think we'd have to admit that and have to embrace it. There's lots of room for human error and the laughter at it. And I would hope that this book, above all, creases people up a little bit. I managed to even laugh myself whilst writing it, and writing's the most agonising thing imaginable. So I take that as a guide.
That's a great sign, then. And Percival's nodding along here to that. You obviously find something in that as well in the terms of the humour.
I'm mainly envious. I haven't had the opportunity to laugh while working at all. So.
One day that'll happen.
That's right.
And what have you been reading and enjoying recently?
Well, first of all, I want to back out of this book off thing at the end, because Andrew just describes books so well. I concede. I've been reading about the composer Dvorak. There's a book, Dvorak's A Prophecy, by a man named Joseph Horowitz, and I think it's great. It's about Dvorak's time in America when he comes in 1892 or 3 and is brought to help establish an American serious music. American composers to that point were making music because they'd been trained by German romanticists and so making, what you would expect them to make, German romantic music. he came and being Dvorak, who drew on Slavic folk songs and dances for his music, he said to Jeanette Thurber, I think, the woman who brought him over to be the director of the National Conservatory, your music will be found in your folk music. And for Dvorak here, that folk music were the songs that came from this, as was the folk music of America, were plantation and work songs from slaves. Those were the songs that people sang. And Native American melodies, he said also. And so it's just a fascinating world that's rendered in. The other book, I guess it couldn't be more different, is a book called The Kingdom of Characters by a woman named Jing Tsu. She's a professor at Yale University. And it's about how the Chinese language was an impediment for the Chinese entering the participation in the modern world. 3,500 characters. It's not phonetic. How do you build a typewriter? And and so there, much of the beginning of the book deals with building the Chinese typewriter, which there were a lot of models, and some took and some didn't. And then there's a discussion of telegraphy, which, how do you send these ideograms on a telegraph? So people came up with systems. So instead of 3,500 characters, you have 400 that have pieces. There's a book that comes with these 400 pieces, and you must put it together, and they're represented by four-digit numbers. In reading this book, you realize how it was that Mao had so much success rallying the country against these Western invaders. But it turns out that sending a number, a number, costs more than sending a letter. So as they're sending these, they're sending four numbers instead of a letter, and they're spending so much money sending messages that very seldom get received and translated. And much of it is about how the Chinese had to participate in conferences to try to get a foot into them in the modern world.
Oh, wow. Fascinating.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating.
Yeah. The Kingdom of Characters,
yes.
That one's called. And the Dvorak is Prophecy.
Dvorak's Prophecy.
Oh, yeah. I fancy both of those. In fact, all of those ones. I've written them all down, so thank you. Thanks for those recommendations. And it's time for another, because it is time for the Book Off, where each of you gets to tell us about a book that you love, that you think we should all read. It can be anything you like. I never use the phrase favourite book, because I don't think that can exist. Mm-hmm. But a book that everyone should read, I think, is a bit broader. Now, before we get into it, there's a little bit of admin we have to do. We always say the person that's travelled the furthest gets to decide if they go first or second. Now, that is undoubtedly you, Percival, because even though Andrew's in Scotland, you've come from sunny California, so I think you get to decide if you go first or second.
I do not want to follow. Andrew.
You're putting yourself up first. Very good.
And I'd like your show to have a really great ending. I'll go first.
Very good. You're very considerate. And that's also subtly put a bit of pressure on him, which I like as well. Yep. Now, you have 3 minutes, as I say. It is uninterrupted. If you're still talking, though, at the three-minute mark, I'll either be ringing you out with the bell or we'll be honking you out. Andrew, which one would you like for your three-minute marker?
Certainly the honker.
We're going to have the horn. Okay, no problem. I'm going to put 3 minutes on the clock then. And just before you launch into it, Percival, tell us the book that you're putting forward, please.
The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy by Lawrence Stern.
Okay, 3 minutes on the clock. Over to you.
Okay. I love this novel because I don't believe there's any such thing as postmodern literature. And yet in 1741, the most postmodern of all novels was published. The fact that Stern, throughout the novel, talks to the reader is remarkable. That he employs every kind of literary communication available to him at the time is beautiful. But what I love most about the novel is it never gets started. It's just a series of digressions. One digression leads to another. And so the novel, which is ostensibly about the life and opinions of Tristram Shandy, we never get past his conception. It's, quite frankly, beautiful. It's what I wish I had made. And I'm disappointed that I didn't make it to 3 minutes because I wanted to hear a bell or something.
Oh, you can hear a bell. If you're going to bring that in, that's fine.
I'll stop since you rang the bell.
Is it wrong that I don't know this book?
It is terribly wrong that you don't know this book.
Okay, good. That's probably what I thought. Okay, we'll come back and talk about it in a bit because I'm so underread, honestly, and I do this podcast and I get wonderful writers on and they tell me about books and I'm constantly thinking, I should have read that probably. Okay, we'll come back and talk about it, surely, Percival. But you only used a minute and a bit, so, you know, there's obviously more to say. I'm going to put 3 minutes back on the clock for you, Andrew. Before we start it, tell us the book you're putting forward, please.
Well, I'm very tempted to concede because of the quality of Percival's choice. I think the Life and Times of Tristram Shandy is such a masterpiece and such a progenitor of so many of the wonderful novels, not only the postmodern ones, but, such wonderful experimental novels we've seen in the centuries since. But it was a mere 145 years after the publication of Tristram Shandy, we have my favourite novel, if I can call it that, which is The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson, my countryman, and published in 1886, written in Bournemouth that year after a particularly bad nightmare suffered by poor old Robert Louis Stevenson, a night fever to beat all night fevers, where he woke up in the morning and immediately picked up the pen and started writing this ghastly tale of a very ordinary, orderly, vulnerable doctor who, despite having an Edinburgh name and having a kind of Edinburgh bearing, is actually living in Marylebone in London. And we discover very quickly in this strange tale that our man is two men, that when he takes a certain potion, he turns into the ghastly, not to say evil, figure of Mr. Hyde. Now, the reason I love this book is it's you wouldn't change two words in the whole book. It's perfectly written. It's a piece of, when people say things are well written, I think it's a sort of almost a cliche. They bandy it about too easily. This book is perfectly written, tone by tone, unsaid thing by unsaid thing, and every expression is in its place. He bumped the first verse. His wife told him he'd missed the allegory and it wasn't quite right. Who needs a wife like that, I say. But he wrote it again in 3 days, and that is the version that we have. This utterly beautiful, symbolist, modernist short novel, which somehow goes to the core of what it is to be a human being, that to say, gives airtime to duality, to the two-ness, to the doubleness of human life. It's psychologically true in a way that rings right through the culture. That's why it was one of the first of all novels with the birth of cinema to be filmed, and it's been filmed almost more than any other single tale. It's a brilliant piece of penetrating psychology as well as a ringing narrative. I find myself going back to it again and again. I just find it sort of so enveloping. It's like a Greek myth. It's almost impossible to believe that this novel was written by one person. It seems to pre-exist the writing of it, almost as if it's carved out of rock. It's like a myth in that way. It's just a truth about human nature that doesn't take invention or composition. It just is. And for me, as a writer, you just have to live with the sad, sorry, and unbelievably depressing truth that one will never write anything as good as The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'm all for it. Please tell me it's time for the horn.
It is. You did it. Well done. What a fabulous pitch.
I love being right.
Yeah. goodness me. Well, what a... two fabulous book choices. So I have to come back. You can take a break now, Andrew. You can have a sip of water. The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy. So I've gone wrong here. Something's gone wrong because I haven't read this. And hearing you talk about it, I already knew that this was a book I should have picked up. And obviously, Andrew knew straight away. He's read it. But what I loved about your pitch for it, as someone who hasn't read it, is the fact that you talk about it never getting started, that this is a novel that essentially... And that's one of the things that you love about it, right?
Yes. His father, Walter, and his uncle, Toby, are huge characters, but Tristram never is.
Right, I see. And I think this thinking this is, so this is 18th century, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. And this is obviously, a huge inspiration to many that followed then that I just haven't realized. Many books that followed and many authors that followed.
Well, yes. And it's as Andrew was saying, it not only spawned or is ancestor to what are called postmodern novels, but many experimental novels, modernist mm-hmm. works. Just breaking down what we can clumsily call the fourth wall of the writer intruding and messing with the reader. It's great fun.
Yeah, and being, and I suppose at this time, doing that in 1741 or whatever it was, is, you know, was just is unheard of.
There's a black page in the novel.
Oh, really?
Just black.
Really? That's amazing. <Yeah. laughs> Okay, I've got to go and pick this up now. I've really got to read this, haven't I? And then I wasn't expecting, and that's a great thing, for you to bring The Strange Case of Jekyll and Hyde into the book off, Andrew. I'm really glad you did. I'm sort of fascinated by it, I suppose, because I hadn't ever really thought about it in terms that you were talking about how... you know, I've seen a lot of adaptations of it. You said it's possibly one of the first yeah. novels to be filmed, and there's been so many of them as well.
So many, yes.
And I think of it a bit like that, because I saw it before I ever read it. But actually, it's the psychological advancement of it, I suppose, that I've never thought of. And it's obviously a book that you're incredibly passionate about. Coming back to when we were talking earlier about your own books, and Percival has read Huckleberry Finn 15 times in a row again and again, I'm not suggesting you've done that, but this is evidently something that you've come back to and continue to go back to, is it?
There's a nice relationship between the two books that we've chosen today, actually, because they're each seen to be sort of progenitors, if that's the right word, of modernist work in the literary field. That Borges, the great South American writer's favourite book, was The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There's a kind of, there's a majestic, almost bad dream, deep psychological, disturbed aspect, a kind of ethereal aspect to the prose. I was always fascinated by the fact that the great Henry James adored Robert Louis Stevenson. These are two writers who, on the surface, couldn't be less like each other, the very composed splicer infinitely of consciousness that is Henry James next to this adventure writer. You know, Robert Louis Stevenson and James loved each other, and they loved each other primarily as stylists, albeit that their treatment and their subject matter was very different. So I love that, reaching across from nation to nation, that writers can find something in each other's work. They might never write a sentence that the other would write, but they've got energy, they've got a sense that they can gain something mm-hmm. from the other person's vision.
I also was just amazed that he dumped the first draft, as you said, and then just wrote this one in 3 days. We'll just get this one out in three days.
No, I mean, it's just like intolerable. I mean, I spend my whole life in a sea of self-loathing that the previous sentence isn't better than it is. And the idea of allowing one's loved one to put a full book into the fire and then gleefully start again. No. The divorce courts were built for something.
Yes, that's right. Well, I loved both of these pictures. I loved both choices. And I have to say, you know, I've got to go and read this novel. I can't believe I haven't, so thank you for bringing it to my attention. There'll be lots of people listening who are like, what do you mean? You haven't read it, but there might be some that haven't as well that are going to go to it. And I just love the Robert Louis Stevenson as well. I'm going to take the Jekyll and Hyde home. I think we're going to take the Jekyll and Hyde. I think you've just pipped it, and you both sort of conceded on each other's choices, so you're probably happy whichever way that went, to be honest, based on...
Join effort.
I lost during the weigh-in.
It's been a real pleasure speaking to you both. Thank you so much for joining me and talking about your books, which I absolutely loved. James is by Percival Everett. It's out now. It's published by Mantle, and Caledonian Road by Andrew O'Hagan, also out now, published by Faber. Thank you both for being here and for a brilliant conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure meeting you, Andrew.
Great to meet you, Pedro.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.